Before we get started with today's episode, we need to tell you that we've finally launched our Patreon page. It's patreon.com/AustTrueCrimePod. That's AUST, True Crime Pod. But don't worry about remembering that because the link is in the notes to this episode and on our socials. And if you don't know what Patreon is, it's a way for us to make exclusive extra content for you and for you to pay us what you think it's worth. It's very easy. So become a patron and you'll get lots of extra exclusive perks, including an extra episode of Australian True Crime every month. And we want to thank everyone who's jumped on board already, especially Amy Zalowski. That's how I'm pronouncing it, Amy. She wanted to know how I was going to do it. I'm saying Zalowski. She's from New South Wales, and she was our very first patron, and we're sending you a stack of books, Amy, by authors featured on the podcast. Thank you so much. I hope you like them. Okay, let's get on with the show.
So we had to do the Aldi thing last week. Well, my wife's organic.
Yeah.
So, so it was very humbling for her. She's sitting in Aldi's going, I hate Aldi's bread. And I said, don't blame the bread, love. I said, you hate the concept. And I said, look, I love your morals and I love, you know, what you stand for, but this was reality and the people we work for, we're going to be working for and with, this is how they live. This is why we have to go through this lesson.
You may find this hard to believe, but that man was, at one time, one of the most feared enforcers in the Melbourne underworld.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Today's story is of a life in two parts. Part two of James Harding's life is about encouraging men to get to the root causes of their violent and self-destructive behaviour, which he can speak about with some authority, because part one was about pushing himself to become the most violent human being possible. James was a member of the Melbourne underworld during the infamous gang wars of the late 90s and early 2000s. Unlike many of his colleagues, he left the scene of his own accord and lived to tell the tale. As you're about to hear, the tale starts very early.
So 4 years old, I was at school and it backed onto a train line. And this is the 80s when armed robbery was the main earn. There was a little bit of drugs. But this is the armed robbers and armed robbery squad. They were as ruthless as the crooks. Don't worry about that. So an armed robbery had just happened and they're burning down North Road. They flew through the train tracks, the robbers, just as the gates were going down. They flew through. The cops were following. Train, bang, and killed the coppers and pushed the train, and I'm standing there staring at it as a four-year-old. And I've just seen the carnage, teachers, it's chaos. Teachers grab us inside. I said, got home. I said to Dad, what's a robber? And Dad explained it to me. And then I can hyper-focus on things. And then I made him, we watched The Godfather, The Untouchables, all the good stuff.
Scarface.
And I was just like, how much romance is there? These people just do what they like. And also when I was 4 years old, the proper godfather of the honoured society at the Footscray markets and across Australia, I went to school with his grandson. So I was always at their house, and you've got to understand this is the 80s and it was just uncles and cash, and I was exposed to just some of the best stuff.
Was your dad into it? Was your family?
No.
No.
No, Dad's – look, Dad's from Northcote.
Uh-huh.
And it's a different place to what it is now. So his dad's he knows what's goes on, but no, he's not like that.
Not involved, but aware.
Yeah.
Aware. And so
very switched on.
So they knew this family and they
Everybody knew this family.
Okay.
Yeah. And like what can he say? We were just two mates and but when I was around there, and you gotta understand, we were going to the pools, like my family, and we were getting under surveillance. This is how serious they were. When the godfather died, there were 5,000 people at his funeral from all over the world.
Wow.
He's actually the top dog. And everybody talks these days, they know someone and everyone, mafia, it's bullshit.
Mm.
This guy was fair dinkum. I will never say his name, but I'll tell you after.
Yeah.
If you Google him, you'll see who I'm talking about. So I guess the writing was on the wall there. I was always exposed to it, and not that I consciously thought, hang on a minute, I'm going to do this, but there was an allure to it.
I get it.
Yeah. There's something kind of romantic.
Absolutely.
Looking back at all that armed robbery squad stuff. Like,
I sort of was like drawn to it as well as a young person.
Mm.
And then when I, in the late 90s, I started working as a receptionist in brothels in Melbourne.
Did you really?
Yeah. And I sort of started running into some people, and then I got scared real quick and thought, oh, no, I don't want anything to do with them real quick. So that's what separates you and I, because when you started running into them for real, obviously it didn't scare you off at all.
No, I've always had an unwavering self-belief and confidence.
Yeah.
Not to say I haven't struggled with self-worth.
Yeah.
The ability to always know I'm going to be okay and get through anything and survive and prosper. And
so when did you really start actively working in the industry?
Yeah, so, I mean, we were taking hard drugs at 15 after a really violent incident that me and a mate were exposed to.
What was that?
Oh, we're coming home from a party and these two Middle Eastern guys, father and son, random, were hell-bent on revenge. We were walking down the street. I never used to drink, which is ironic, and my mate was blind. He was walking down the street. I was just to the side on a skateboard, and they ran over him first.
Oh, wow.
In a car. Mm. And then they got out, and they were both carrying, like, swords, and they came at me. I put my hand board up to defend myself, fell back over a fence as I was walking backwards, and they turned on him and just cut him to pieces, hacked him up.
Did he die?
No, but, I mean, we're talking lacerations from there to there.
Like from the ear to the chin.
Yeah, so it was just above the jugular and then one just above the temple. So they were trying. I mean, he came at me. So what happened was the guilt that I felt was I couldn't get up. I was in the garden bed in the dirt and I wanted to, but I was frozen stiff with fear. Now, I've never felt that fear before, but I could hear what was happening to him. And when I got up finally and they're driving off and he runs towards me, I mean, there was just blood everywhere. And he looks at me and goes, puts his tongue through the hole in his cheek, touches his thing and he goes, am I going to be all right? And I, you know, I'm just like, come on, man, I've got to get you back to my house. So the fear and that lack of being able to compose myself, I think was the driver for all of it, because I thought to myself, when I did the work on myself, I realised afterwards I became this super protective, just this beast.
A hypervigilant? You know how they talk about that.
Yeah, I just wanted to protect and hurt anyone that got in my way. And when it came to revenge, I mean, I've only addressed the revenge thing the last 2 years. I love to give out receipts. If anyone that's close to me is hurt, or then I'd go after that person without even thinking about it. You wouldn't even have to ask me.
Mm.
And when you work, when you do the work, you realise it's all, when you scale it back, it's all attached to that moment. So we started taking drugs, and then he was an Albanian. They're serious people. Yeah. And, like we sort of had all the connections already with, and then, you know, we're rocking and rolling and one thing led to another. I mean, you be careful what you wish for. Because I sort of thought, it was premeditated what I did though. I thought, I'm going to have a good go at this. I mean, when I left school, I thought, I want to be a gangster.
Mm.
I didn't want to go to uni. And I thought, I said to myself when I started, 5 years, James, 25 years old, you're pulling the pin. And I stuck to that.
Mm.
But I thought, the experience I'll get in that will set me up for life. And I was dead on about that.
How do you become a gangster? Like, how do you...
No, there's no TAFE courses.
Like, what do you
do? Seek.com.au,
no,
I think.
No, none of that.
There might be a TEDx talk on how to do it. I don't know.
Yeah. You just roll the dice and, you know, I knew where to look. And
You've just got to, you would have to be, like, just super scary all the time, yeah?
Yeah, that comes. You learn the grim at the face and you learn the walk and, you know, you've got to buy a lot of jewellery. And
my dad's a jeweller. He'll like to
do that. Yeah, I had so much jewellery, and you got to. I had hair then too, so that'd all be back, and slowly you accumulate tattoos, and and your persona grows. The funniest thing is, I had a mate that was a look. He's done 15 to 20 years jail on and off, not in one stint. And were at the bar 20 one night. And he's not a huge guy, but everyone at bar 20 was terrified of him. And I looked at him, I said, how does this work? And he looked at me, I'll never forget it. He goes, James, if you look and act a certain way, everybody else falls into line.
Mm-hmm.
Now I took, forget about the gangster and the underworld and all that. If you take that into normal life as well, and you're really trying to get somewhere and be something, I think that's really applicable.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah,
it's really applicable to life, especially when you're trying, you're getting knocked back. But if you genuinely believe it,
look like you belong somewhere and then no one questions you.
No.
Yeah.
Do you know where I do that?
Where?
At the airport. I always do it in the line. You know where you're going through the x-rays?
Yeah.
I always get in the line for business passengers when I'm flying economy. Always. Yeah. And
unbelievable.
And no one, try it, no one ever says, have you got a booking, like a pass?
They probably recognise you too.
No, I swear to God, no one ever says, have you got a business boarding pass? They just put you through that line. That. Yeah, so there's 100 people lined up for the other ones. There's no one in the business one?
Yep.
Just look like, of course I'm meant to be in this line. Yeah.
I find it's being amazing. Tall,
that's exactly what
you.
I'm talking about. Yeah.
I used to hate being tall, but now I try and carry it because when you're a bit bigger, you can just sort of
you look
stride.
Like you should be in the
you
business
are a,
line.
A
fake
tall
it
woman.
To make it, yeah.
But I heard someone the other day that tall people live happier lives.
So you get into the business, you know where to look.
Yeah.
You go there and you're prepared. So what are your first jobs? When you're a young bloke and you've just shown up, do they give you some, do you have to prove yourself? Is that whole look?
Yeah. Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
You do. So I was ultra violent early.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing is, what people will never understand about the underworld is it's like the royal family. It's all inbred. Everyone knows everyone. Yeah. Everyone's sleeping with everyone. And they're the biggest gigs going around. And when I say that, I mean they love to gossip.
Mm.
And the whole thing about it's just such a contradiction because you're supposed to be staunch and quiet and we don't talk, but it's just if something happens, everybody knows about it.
Yeah.
Everybody, and everybody talks about it. So I knew I had to go hard early and be really violent early, and then word sort of filters and then you're sort of around people and you get trusted. And it was always to do with drugs and moving and collections and stuff like that. And if you're reliable and honest, you know, you supersede anyone in that industry because most people are addicts and the drugs direct where their allegiances and moral compass is, and, you know, they're easy to buy in that world.
And obviously you're smart too.
I'm well educated, great family. So I talk about the iceberg theory. One third of the top of me was the bravado and the masculinity and all the bullshit, but underneath it, the foundations that underneath the water was just rock solid.
Mm.
Like I had an amazing upbringing family, and I knew within sort of 1 or 2 years when I love studying people, and I've always had a really high intuition and be able to read people, and you're really tested in that industry. But with that, I was always watching people, and I used to think within 2 years of seeing the patterns over and over, I thought, I've got these people covered.
Mm.
You know, really, it might be arrogant, but I think, is this it?
Mm.
Like, this is so basic. It's like the underworld pride themselves on resilience. It's funny because I was at Father's Day at my school yesterday, and a career criminal I know well, his son's there as well, and his missus just got banged up. She got caught with a whole heap of ice, and she's looking at a couple of years, and he comes up to me and tells me the story because he can't talk to anyone at the school about it. And he repeats the story over and over and over again, right? And then he'll say, no, but I'm fine. So the underworld pride themselves on resilience. I think that's a dirty word, and I think it's really overplayed in society because it's like, no, we've got it. And the whole underworld's like that. We're resilient. But really the emotional pain never gets addressed. But we're resilient. Mm. But every time you see them, they'll be telling you the same thing over and over again.
It's like that stiff upper lip thing, you know, the British thing, just, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and...
Yeah.
So interesting. You're making me think of Andrew Rule's podcast, which is excellent.
Yeah.
And he was talking about Alphonse Gangitano.
I was just thinking of Alphonse.
Remember, and he made the point that when, at the time of his death, Alphonse was on antidepressants, was on various medications, was in debt. You know, so this whole Dark Prince of Ligon Street persona was actually hiding a man who was probably quite unhappy.
Well-educated too.
Oh, absolutely.
Very well-educated. Amazing family from what I understand.
Yeah.
I know people that were very close to Alf. And when he got sloughed up for, I think, bashing someone or something,
yeah,
and he was in prison, he was shaking from withdrawals.
Would have been the nightclub bashing with Jason.
He was real violent, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, well, the guy I'm talking about whose missus just got pinched with the ice, I mean, his dad and another guy brought Alphonse through. He was the next sort of generation. And when I asked him, the dad, he said, mate, he was vicious. But he always picked his mark, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So it's so fascinating to hear you talk now, because it's like, when did you get this kind of this level of self-understanding? Was it always there? Were you always this self-aware of what, of who you really were and what you were really doing? When did this happen? When was there a breakthrough moment where you became who you are now, James?
No, I've always been the same ever since I was a kid.
So was it, did you really just on your 25th birthday go, okay, now I'm the other James?
Yeah. Yeah, I pulled the pin. I was
like, get a job in waste to the market.
Yeah, I was like, you said it, and I just moved away. The underworld war was raging.
Yeah.
A good mate of mine's dad was knocked out in Kew.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's it, perfect excuse. And I was gone, moved up the coast, over the border. I told the Albanian, tell everyone I got caught interstate on a gun thing and I'm doing time. And that's it. Just moved up and started. I was 77 kilos. I'm 100 now. I was that, like, from the drugs.
Oh, you were using as well?
Oh, heavily.
Right.
I'm like, Benny Cousins and my life, it kills me when I hear what's happening with him, because we were so close in our lives running parallel. And I look at him and think, that could have so easily been me. So, yeah, I just needed – it's all instinct with me. I run always on instinct. And in a lot of ways, Michelle, I feel like I've been on this planet many times, right? I hope that sort of makes sense. And
I'm
just,
Buddhist, mate. That makes complete sense to me. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so I just knew that I had to move away. I needed to get in the country with real people, because I needed to start trusting people and then start trusting myself again. It was all instinct, and I knew where to go. I hadn't been there in years. Moved up there, started playing footy, and, you know, work had dry up there, and I was forced to come back to Melbourne and do some things really quietly. And then, I was moving product and bits and pieces across the border, and it still continued to linger. But I made the decision, and I was so naive in the fact that I thought 25, I'll pull the pin and it's done. It took another 10 years.
Yeah.
Of deep emotional work and just telling people, I'm not doing this anymore. And even now, if you see someone, even like my mate yesterday, it's like they're like, it's a vampire type thing. They just, it's an instinct thing for them. They just want to bring you back, and like the scene in The Godfather, they pull me back in. Yeah.
Yeah, because I guess for them, it doesn't feel good to see a bloke get out and change his life successfully.
No, and that's true, Michelle, but then you got the ones that are your fair-dinkum people that they're just so proud.
Yeah.
That you put your hand up and using everything, because I know guys with, like, the old school heads of the underworld. I mean, he's got 10 kids and, you know, I think he's getting affectionate and emotional in his old age. This is a hard man, and when I told him what I was doing, he was just so supportive.
Yeah, wow.
You know, because their 10 kids are to different wives and stuff, and it's not perfect. But to put your hand up and say, right, I'm on the front line now, and this is what I stand for, and I will do anything. Like, me and my wife, I was laughing about it yesterday, we had $150 for the week.
People think you're famous, don't they? Online or rich or something, and
Yeah, they see that, and then they see the TV and the book, and they think, oh, you're flying. Yeah, so not
like,
the case.
Yeah, we're about to start a Patreon page for, like, our listeners to, you know, become our patrons and, like, subscribe to the podcast for the same reason.
Yeah.
We've had 7 million downloads, and it's like, yeah, but we're not making much money.
So, someone asked me, they go, do you work as well? I went, I work full-time because I'm paying my mortgage. This is my passion.
Definitely a passion project.
Yeah.
So, we understand, absolutely.
So what exactly is it that James stands for now? What's the project that's keeping his family broke when he could be running drugs across the border for tens of thousands of dollars a week? Find out after the break. Coming up on Australian True Crime, we'll hear some stories from James about the children who keep him going. But first, James talks about his mission, Hard Cuddles.
I'm prepared to lose my house and lose everything to do this, to see this through. Because some of the stuff we're doing with men and some of the stuff that's happened in the last 2 days with people that need help, it's just, I've never been more sure of anything in my life. And Dad rang me the other day. He goes, you're right, son, do you need anything? I said, Dad, we're right. He said, don't starve. He said, ask me. And I said, yeah. And he goes, mate, you're meant to be doing this, and I'd tell you if you weren't. And I'm thinking to myself, if you told me this wasn't right for me, I'd tell you to fuck off.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This needs to be done.
It's very of the moment and it needs to be done, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And I think, I have to say, I think it's even more impressive given that I've got a funny feeling you could go and make tens of thousands of dollars tomorrow.
Yeah.
Going back to your old profession if you wanted to.
One phone call.
So let's talk about what it is you are doing. What is Hard Cuddles?
So even especially, it started in the underworld and organised crime. I noticed men would come up and just tell me stuff. And it's happened since I was a kid, like people would come up and hug me and I'd be a little kid and I'd never understood why, and the blokes would be at pubs and a bloke would walk up. Never met him. I was raped when I was 14. I'm like,
oh my God.
You're choosing this time right now to tell me, are you, mate?
Wow.
So it was all those things that started to stack up. Then when I did the work and looked at the bigger picture, I thought, I know what I'm meant to be doing in life. So then we made the call. Hard Cuddles, I'm an excellent listener, like active listening.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done enough work. I never saw counsellors or psychs or anything. Not that it doesn't work. It just was never going to get it done for me because I don't believe personally, and this is just my view, that you take a drug to mask an emotional problem. I believe you work straight through the issue and understand it and strip it back. And so I saw all these energy healers and psychics and clairvoyants and kinesiologists and did that thing.
Yeah, wow.
And everyone that I saw, I'd take one little bit and I thought, this is applicable to men, this is going to work, that's not going to work, and just kept it in the memory bank. And now when I'm working with men, it's completely up to that person. So I do a lot of one-on-one work with men. We do the retreats where I've got one booked in soon where I take young hoons and males back to nature, surfing, fishing, spearfishing, paddleboarding, the real stuff.
Yeah.
I don't do the healing. Nature does the healing. I do a lot of public speaking. That's the ultimate high, because I still need that adrenaline.
Yeah.
You know, like that world where you test yourself in serious situations where there's harm and stuff, and that's the greatest drug of all. When you're in the moment and you are, there's no outside thought, past, future, you're engaged and you're 100% present, public speaking gets that done for me. Do you know what I mean? Because I don't take any click, you know, with the clicks and the presentations.
Yeah,
I just go full bore. Yep. And I say, give me one word what you want to talk about. And I've got so many stories that aren't even in the book. And, the public speaking's amazing. We do men's circles, a lot of healing in that.
What happens in there?
Sometimes I go in with a subject, and other times I'll just let the guys go.
Just follow their lead.
And we get it in a big circle, and some pretty hard men and some pretty soft men. We keep it real. That's amazing. And
are there any sort of – are there commonalities? Are there common themes that are coming out in these circles? Are there common struggles among men?
Yeah, absolutely.
Modern men.
Good, great question too.
What are they talking about?
90% of it, when you strip it back, is self-worth.
Why is that? I have a theory that what we're asking from men, or the place that we want men to occupy in the world, has changed so dramatically in the last 50 years.
Yeah.
Don't you think we've taken it's a lot so away tricky. From men? It's like, I feel like 50 years ago, men were the leaders of the house, the breadwinner. Yes. They were treated with so much respect. You know, shush, your dad's watching TV. Yeah.
Wait
shush,
till your dad gets home.
Go and get your dad a beer. Yeah. You know, your dad gets the money and he gives me the housekeeping money and all that. I feel like white men in Australia had a lot going for them. We've taken a lot away.
Yeah.
We haven't replaced it with anything.
Yeah, so what I believe we're in a transition process. The male energy, I mean, if you look at things, women's energy is healing by nature. Mm-hmm. It's nurturing and there's so much healing with the female energy, and males burned them at the stake.
Yep.
You remember traditionally they were, because witches and traditionally they were able to heal.
Yep.
So men took on this thing and we're in charge now, and look where we are now. Look at the state of the world, right? So I believe it's a transition where female energy will come back, and I think there's going to be an overcorrection. And I think that's terrifying men at the moment. I think your guys like your Trumps and this sort of stuff is the last of the kicking and the screaming.
Yeah.
I think there'll be an overcorrection and then a balance. Now, why I say that is because I was so ego-driven, and it was all my self-worth was underneath that lack of self-worth. And it wasn't until I allowed my wife to show me how to balance and my daughters to balance up my own male and female energy.
Yeah.
Did I realise, hang on a minute, this female thing is just magic.
Yeah.
The vulnerability, it's so tricky at the start. It's awkward and it's like, oh, what's this? Yeah. And then you get through that little bit and then it's like I'm crying all the time now, not sadness but happiness, and just so open to the magic.
Yeah.
And there's magic everywhere. Like I'm driving here and I'm crying over songs and thinking to myself, my God, you have changed as a human being. And that's why I say, and I said to Jane Caro the other day, the female energy is going to heal the earth. And this, and I will tell anyone this, and if you don't agree with me, that's fine. I don't need you to agree with me.
But I think it's really,
feel it.
It's powerful coming from you. Yes. Like, you know, if we were to say it, or if Jane Caro's to say
people will roll their eyes. Yeah. Oh, the femos are at it again.
But I feel like it needs... Men need to hear it from men, and they need to hear it from men like you, who can, no one can ever argue that you're not a masculine man.
And you are, like you do, you look like a strong, tough guy.
Yeah.
Like, it's strong now, and thank you, strong in a different way now. My strength is my vulnerability now and showing men, hey, this is tight, and I'll stand in front of anyone and say that that's okay. But my son, my oldest boy, has just got this beautiful energy, takes after his mother, and the kids at his school, there's one particular boy, Archie's just taken a shine to him, and I'm just so proud of him.
Yeah.
Because he's got the balance right already. And then there's a kid that lives two doors up from us. Now, I know the language and I know the body language and the way they are. And I knew that this family is struggling, and I've never seen the old man around. Anyway, it was Father's Day and they do bacon and egg rolls, $5 a go at the primary school, and I'm standing there, and his little mate has come up and he's standing one out. And I could tell he just wanted, and I said, where's Dad, mate? And he said, Dad drove off when he found out Mum was pregnant. And I'm thinking, this is a seven-year-old kid. He's aware of this stuff.
Mm.
And I gave him a hug and I said, why haven't you got a role? Is anyone here with you? He said, no. I said, why haven't you got a roll? He said, I haven't got any money. I said, come on, mate, we'll sort this out. And then I got him a roll, and he just wanted to be included.
Yeah.
So I gave him another hug and got home, and it really affected me. And I told my wife and I told Dad, and I said, Dad, I'm so proud I'm on the front line with this stuff, because I'll go to his mum now and say, hard cuddles is what we're about. If you like, I can include him and different things, because there's no male role model. Now, I'm not going to sit here and judge why his old man isn't there, but I can guarantee you it's got to do with emotions and his inability to deal with them. So with hard cuddles and this podcast and everything when I talk about the male and female energy and the recalibration, there's amazing change happening. And I'm so proud that I've got a wife who's supportive enough when I said we're going to sell everything. Because we had the life. Don't worry about that. We had cars and functions and all that.
Where's your jewelry gone?
Sold all that. We know. I had to. Yeah. I had to yeah. to do this, right? Wow. Good question. To have a wife supportive enough, I said, we got to do this. And she said, go for it. How good's that?
That's amazing.
Do you know what I mean? And if I heard that story with this young fella yesterday and I wasn't able to do anything about it, you'd just stew over it. I would anyway. But to be on the front line now and say, hang on a minute, I'm doing something about this. I put my, what do I do, my meditations and stuff, affirmations last night. I don't claim abundance. I demand it now. I said, I'm doing everything I can. You've got to help me upstairs. So there's a lot of vulnerability even in this, you know, like it's a wild ride. It really is. And that's why, you know, you're reaching out to everyone. And people see the book and they see a little bit of television, and that's the tip of the spear. Behind that is that many no's and rejections and people just flat out not even getting back to you. Yeah. That's why I wanted to get in contact with Michelle. I know how to read people's faces, and it's funny. Dad taught me this very young. You look at someone's head and you're able to tell whether they're fair dinkum or not. I knew looking at her face that she was fair dinkum.
I got a fair dinkum head.
Yeah, a lot of pretenders out there.
She is fair dinkum.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Oh, that's good to know. Well, I mean, the other thing that I love about your story is that, you know, sometimes on this show we talk about offenders and offenders' families. And a couple of weeks ago I went and visited some prisons in Castlemaine, and some people sort of say, you know, no, I don't have any time for those people and they're criminals and they're, you know, and you are helping us, you're reminding us that, you know, what we are today isn't what we always have to be. And that, you know, we're always changing, we're always evolving. And sometimes a drug dealer can turn out to be just the most incredible giving person who is changing the lives of other people and children. With no dad there on Father's Day. I mean, that's massive.
Well, it's exactly right, Michelle. Like, I remember thinking towards the end of when I was really coming good and getting stronger. My wife was pregnant with one of our early, I can't remember which one. I said to her in the middle of the night, come, let's go to Macca's at about 12 o'clock. Right? So we drive down to Frankston. It was about 12 or 1. We hook in. We're sitting there. I go to water. So I never actually saw this, but I could feel what was happening. I was periphery sort of thing. She said, James, did you see that? And I said, I saw something. And she said, see that three-year-old kid there, 3-year-old, 1 o'clock on a Saturday night, Frankston McDonald's, eating his chips. He's just sitting there like that. And his parents were fighting and just erratic and went into the disabled toilets to plug, right?
That means have drugs.
Yeah.
For our listeners,
That's right.
It's a glossary of terms.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And this little fella sitting there eating his chips, his 3-year-old, and I thought to him, it haunts me.
Yeah.
Because I, my wife, this is why she's my muse. This always gets me the story. So we're driving home and I remember thinking there's people, sports stars for, you know, there's all these heroes and mentors for people that are successful and go to good schools. Who represents the kids that grow up in the Broadmeadows Commission flats, Paran Commission flats? Who represents for the kids that grow up in crime families that show you can use these skills to live a really successful life? And why I had to see that little fellow and why it still haunts me to this day, I remember thinking, what's he going to turn up like, turn out like? And why I tell you that story in relation to that kid the other day, because I thought to myself then and there, I'm going to be that person. Bugger talking about this and telling other people. I'm going to be the guy that stands up saying it's okay not to be perfect. If you've made mistakes, you can use all that to be not only successful but to help other people.
That's James Harding, the founder of Hard Cuddles. He's also the author of the book Hard Cuddles, which is basically the story of his life and what a story it is. You can get it from his website, which is, you guessed it, hardcuddles.com. please show him your support with a Facebook like and an Instagram follow. We've got the links in the podcast notes and on our socials. Thank you to patrons Lucy Neville, Lucy Kazupe, I hope that's right, Louise Burden, Lisa Lisa Perry, Linda Brown, and Laurie Mazer for supporting us on Patreon. I hope I get better at that. Obviously, it lists names alphabetically by first names, which I've just read from the bottom up. And I also chose a random spot to start and to stop, so it's going to be very difficult for me to ensure that everybody gets their shout out. I'm very, very bad at admin. Please get in touch. Oh, I've just got an email as well. Please get in touch if you think I've forgotten you. Don't hesitate to do that, because I accept how bad I am at admin. I'm never offended. Thank you very much for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.